Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
One of the president's ride or die defenders is legal advisor Jenna Ellis.
It's such a political prosecution and a political persecution.
Quote,
this to me is a clear violation of the Fourth Amendment. It's revisionist originalism. Tolerance just isn't a two-way street with the Democrats. And I think that tells you all we need to know.
Newsmax contributor and former legal counsel to President Trump.
Jenna Ellis.
Well, good morning, and we are still in the midst of a huge controversy, I think, nationally over the January 6th videos, and it's surprising to me that so many people are so frustrated that Kevin McCarthy gave all of the footage to Tucker Carlson, who has been releasing clips, when the January 6th Select Committee, all they did for 2 years was release edited clips in a context that only they preferred, without any ability for cross-examination or anyone from the then minority party of the Republicans on the committee. And yet now that the tables are turned on the Democrats, then Chuck Schumer goes out yesterday and is saying, you know, that this is reckless, it's going to undermine democracy, and, you know, all of their ridiculous talking points like that. And the Democrats are just so furious that now, because the Republicans are finally in control, that guess what? We now get the full truth. Now, no one is suggesting that there weren't crimes that were committed on January 6th, that there wasn't violence that happened on January 6th. But what I think is the more pertinent and relevant conversation here and the issue here is that we always need to get to the full truth. And if you have these very selectively edited and curated video content that's put out by a committee that wants to show a narrative that they prefer, then we're not getting the full truth. So I am all for this. And I think that Kevin McCarthy absolutely did the right thing. And it will be interesting to see in the face of course, the court of public opinion and public interest. That's one question, but it will be interesting to see what happens in terms of the January 6th defendants. Already, some of the lawyers for defendants that are yet to stand trial are calling for delays of the trial because they now have apparently new video. So this shows that probably the defense attorneys did not have access to everything here. And that in my mind is a huge violation of due process and something that we all really need to be concerned about. So I want to bring in my first guest, Representative Corey Mills, who we've had on this program before, a good friend of the show. And first I'll start, I want to get to your topic of the important committee hearing later today. But first, I just want to get your overall take as a member of Congress about all of these videos and just getting to the truth. And so do you support Kevin McCarthy's decision here?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, look, at the end of the day, every single American deserves the transparency of what actually took place on January 6th. We don't need this J6 Unselect Committee who cherry picks certain videos to try and substantiate their argument, as opposed to releasing all of the necessary video that shows exactly what took place from all angles and all aspects.
Yeah, exactly. Incredibly well said. And I don't get why that is so controversial. But to the Democrats and, of course, the people who want to just drive their particular narrative, the truth is always controversial. And they always try to suppress the truth in favor of their own propaganda. But, you know, I'm very happy, Representative Mills, that now that we have the Republican majority in Congress, which, of course, you are a part of, that more committees are actually getting to the truth. And the House Foreign Affairs Committee has a select committee that is going to get to the truth of the withdrawal in Afghanistan. And so is it the first hearing that's happening today? I know you're having a hearing. And what do you expect to uncover in this hearing today?
Well, it's the first hearing that we're going to have from the Subcommittee of Oversight, which is headed by Congressman Brian Mast. What we're going to do is we really want to lay out not just what we perceive as failures and political faults with regards to how this was handled, but also the individuals who are actually assisting the veteran groups who are part of the rescues, what they encountered, how much support they had incurred, or whether or not they're actually being thwarted, like with my efforts. And so, you know, I think today it's really just laying the groundwork of some of the individuals who was inside and were current military at the time of what they were seeing, what type of clear directioning that they had, how they were actually told to handle things when it came to who to let in, who not to let in, what was the direction that was given by the State Department, what was the direction given by the Department of Defense, et cetera. And again, this is very personal to me, not only because I had served in Afghanistan, as has many others, but also because, you know, I'm the only member of Congress who actually went over to Afghanistan to make rescues of Americans. We actually did the first successful overland rescue of Americans out of Afghanistan. And so I really want transparency and accountability for the Americans left behind. And I also want transparency and accountability for the 13 brave service members who lost their lives and these new Gold Star families.
Yeah, and this is such an important topic, and I think, you know, just like the January 6th videos and just like so many other things that the Democrats and the Biden administration have withheld from Americans, we need to get to the truth of what actually happened over in Afghanistan. And a lot of people are still concerned as well, Representative Mills, about all of the American military equipment that was left over there and why we pulled out before we actually took all of that military equipment back, and has how and where that has now fallen into the hands, you know, of course, of some of our enemies. And so, you know, is that going to also be something either in this hearing or later on down the road that you're going to investigate?
It's absolutely something that's going to be investigated, not during this hearing today, but certainly we've got a wider range of things that we're going to be dealing with, to include even having Secretary Blinken come in to answer for his decisions. But you're exactly right, Jenna. I mean, we had over $80+ billion in weapons, armament, defense articles, ammunition, millions of dollars in pallets of cash. What Joe Biden and his administration has actually done was make the most well-equipped, well-armed, well-funded terrorist organization in the world, which is the Taliban, Haqqani Network, and ISIS Khorasan. These are the exact individuals that we were spending trillions of dollars, decades of our lives, and thousands of American lives to try and fight against, only to have him arm them and equip them and fund them to a level that's never been seen before.
Yeah, and you know, I have heard, Representative Mills, from many American veterans who served in Afghanistan and who truly, of course, you know, care about the military service like you to the United States, who are so frustrated with how this all happened, because then they think, okay, why was this even worth it? What did we give years of our lives to? And, you know, why was Joe Biden so derelict in his duty to say a specific date and then to leave all of these other contractors for America behind that gave service and help and assistance to the United States, and then all of this equipment? I mean, is there any kind of rationale that Secretary Blinken or others in the Biden administration could provide to your committee that would maybe help us understand and say, okay, this maybe was a little bit rational, instead of from my position here, and I'm not nearly as informed on this topic as you are, but from my position, I'm thinking there's no justification whatsoever for what he did. And I actually think this is an impeachable offense for Joe Biden, and potentially, you know, is your committee looking at referring for articles of impeachment over this issue, depending on what comes out of the committee?
Well, let me first say, I won't speak on behalf of the entire committee, but I think that the actions that took place is irreprehensible. I think that there has to be accountability. I personally think that Secretary Lloyd Austin, as well as for Secretary Anthony Blinken, should be looking at resigning or impeachment. I think that the negligence in duty and the dereliction of duty is very obvious, and there isn't really a whole lot that they can tell me with regards to why they chose political optics over military strategy. Everything from shutting down Bagram Air Base that would have maintained two runways running at the same time, both from a commercial perspective, where Ariana, Cam Air, Emirates could have been launching from the commercial HKIA, and then military and government operations that could have been launched out of Bagram, which had the necessary standoff distance, which had the force protection elements that we needed, which had the ability to house over 40,000 that we could have actually done proper vetting on, something that was not done during this operation, this airlift. the protection of the 13 brave service members, the release of 40,000 terrorist organization members from the Bagram Detention Center, the entire process, which was failed and has resulted in not only our adversaries becoming more emboldened, but now you see what China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea is doing, and that's a direct reflection of them seeing our failures in Afghanistan. Look, weakness invites aggression, and we know this. So what we want to do in this entire thing is that we want to bring to light the mistakes and the failures of this administration. And to quote the former DOD Secretary Gates, he even said that Joe Biden's the only person he knows who's ever been 100% wrong when it comes to foreign policy decisions. Let's go ahead and add this to the bucket.
Wow. And well, you know, I'm reminded of a quotation from President Barack Obama that I can't say on air, but, you know, never underestimate the ability of Joe Biden to screw things up, you know, is basically what he said, but with another choice word that I won't repeat here. And I think that unfortunately that has been the status quo and the modus operandi of the Biden administration, that every time they can choose the wrong path and the most unreasonable, the most unethical, and the most anti-American path, that's what they choose. And so, you know, this doesn't seem like it's just a series of mistakes that, you know, Biden is kind of this bumbling fool, which he is. And, you know, he's up there, he can't even talk on a teleprompter. But, you know, he does have other people who still have, you know, their full mental faculties intact that are working for his administration. And so, you know, what does this say to you, Representative Mills, that every single time that the Biden administration and any agent of the Biden administration can pick the most un-American path, they do? I mean, what is the rationale of the administration that is so against the very country that they're representing?
Look, at the end of the day, this is not fecklessness. This is not ineptitude. This is intentional. We see where they're trying to weaken us militarily, politically, and economically. We see where they chose to leave our borders open. They've chose the soft on crime policy to increase criminality. They've chose to continue the inflationary and out of control spending to drive up our cost of living. They continue to not hold China accountable, who's the greatest adversarial nation that we have today from an economic resource, cyber, and proxy militia perspective. This is an administration which, in my opinion, is completely compromised. This is an administration who is intentionally weakening the United States, where, you know, look at our armed forces, for example. We have a 25,000 personnel shortage on recruitment, not to mention the unconstitutional 8,400 that was purged out for the COVID-19 mandates. And so when you look at this and the fact that there are prioritizing CRT, DEI, and pronouns over increased lethality, readiness, training, and equipping, then that tells you very clearly what the direction is. We are being outpaced economically and militarily by the Chinese. They have a larger Navy now than the United States, the largest in the world, the second largest economy in the world, the largest oil reserves, thanks to President Joe Biden, who has actually sold 40% of our strategic petroleum reserves. And so we have to start calling it for what it is, Jenna. And from my perspective, this is all intentional. This is all about setting an America last agenda. This is about weakening us for China, which is why he handed Bagram Air Base over to China, plus the $1.3 trillion in lithium, but drives forward the ideas of attacking American fossil fuels and American energy to transit into a EV system that he knows that lithium, cobalt, and nickel is mostly dominated and controlled by China. This is nothing more than allowing Chairman Xi to advance this Road and Belt initiative, for our terrorist organizations to be more emboldened against the West, and for us to essentially take second place in a backstage while they try to eliminate the U.S. dollar as the global currency.
Yeah, it is all intentional. And precisely exactly what you said, I think everyone listening to this, this should make you angry. This makes me angry because I love my country, I love my nation, and I want a president and an administration that will put America first because we are Americans. And this is why 2024 matters. This is why we have to step up, and we can't just sit out an election because, you know, the last one and all of the litigation did not go our way. We have to make sure that we are advancing. And Representative Mills, thank you for what you are doing in Congress with those committees, getting to the truth. And we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
The following is not an actor, but a real-life story from Trinity Debt Management.
I'm Corey, and this is my story. I was going through some financial troubles paying off my credit cards. I was paying high interest rates, and it just wasn't getting any better. And I knew I had to do something. So my mom told me about Trinity, and so I decided to call. Trinity was able to do something that I couldn't. I'm paying off my debt, I'm saving thousands, and things are really looking up. I promise you guys, you will not regret it when you call Trinity, because it was such a relief and less stress in my life, and it was the best thing I could have done for myself, because once I called Trinity, they took care of me, and I felt such a relief, a weight off my shoulders, and they are a Christian-based company. I love it.
If you're in debt and you need help, call Trinity at 1-800-788-1813.
I'm Corey, and I'm debt-free for keeps.
1-800-788-1813.
Persecuted believers in Asia, they love their enemies and they count it all joy to suffer for the Lord. This is Bible League International. Abir is a former Islamic leader in Bangladesh. When he became a believer, he was beaten, verbally abused, his home was vandalized, he was forced to move to another city, and he was labeled a traitor. But he holds to the precious promises of God he reads every day in his Bible.
I asked Abir, you were beaten, you were cast out. It's so easy to hate people that do this to you. He said, no, I love them.
Most of us here in America cannot relate to the level of persecution that Christians like Abir in Bangladesh and others throughout Asia are facing on a daily basis. Let's send them the word of God they need and crave to be able to endure and persevere. And that's why we're holding this campaign, Fan the Flame. $5 sends a Bible, $100 sends 20, every gift matched. Call 800-YES-WORD, 800-YES-WORD, or give it sendbiblesnow.org. Sendbiblesnow.org. And God bless you for caring.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes. Stand by for news and commentary next.
Liberty University's K-12 online academy is the best of a homeschool, private school, and Bible-based education all rolled into one. With LUOA, you can take charge of your child's learning environment and create a structured yet flexible schedule that works for your family. Our qualified teachers are easily accessible for guidance and support along the way. And with new classes starting every Monday, it's never too late to make a switch to LUOA. To learn more, text LUOA to 88741. That's LUOA to 88741.
Ron Hiddle had been the fire chief in Stockton, California since 2006. More than a decade later, he was asked by the city manager to attend leadership training. So Chief Hiddle signed up for the Willow Creek Leadership Summit. The chief also invited three colleagues who shared his faith to join the conference. Turns out the city had a problem with the fire chief attending a Christian-themed leadership conference. He was brought up on 10 charges, and the first five were all related to his faith in God. His supervisor threatened to drag his name through the mud, and after months of investigations, he was fired. That was in 2011. Chief Hiddle has been battling the city ever since. Now First Liberty Institute has taken up the case. They say the fire chief's religious rights were violated, and the city of Stockton is sending an illegal message to every employee. Christians need not apply. I'm Todd Starnes.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we are still talking about, of course, the top story this morning in the nation. Everyone is talking about the January 6th videos and Speaker McCarthy giving the entire repository of footage to Tucker Carlson, who, of course, is now putting that out and is doing so in a way that's really undermining the narrative of the January 6th Select Committee, which themselves curated content and only put out what was advantageous, of course, to the Democrats' narrative. And so truth is always the best disinfectant, and sunlight is always a great thing. And, you know, this to me really presents a lot of due process concerns. And so my next guest is Vivek Ramaswamy, who, of course, is a presidential candidate and has been all over not only the nation, but also all over the airwaves and also all over his own Twitter feed as well, really putting out some great policy positions. And so first, Vivek, I want to get to your policy position on a few other issues. But right off the top, I want to get your reaction so far to what you've seen from the January 6th videos. And if you agree that this really does present due process concerns for the J6 detainees.
So I think, Jenna, you hit the nail on the head. There are so many different issues to focus on here, but I focus most on that one because that relates to a core constitutional concern. In this country, the founders had a vision, you know this well, of making sure that before you were criminally prosecuted, that was the number one area of due process protection above all else before we use force to put you in prison in this country. And one of the core principles enshrined in decades of constitutional law is if there is something potentially exculpatory, the defense gets to see it, period. It is not a if, ands, or buts about that. That is just an enshrined principle. And that's why prosecutors have to play a role in this system where they're thinking not about how they can lock you up, but how they can think about what is the just outcome. And the Constitution, our principles guide them to do that. So what does that have to do with this? Well, look, the public now gets to see hours and hours and hours of footage because of Tucker Carlson, right? Mind you, that the Select Committee and others in the government tried to hide this for a long time. But now the public and the government got to see hours of footage that defendants who are either in prison because they were convicted or because they pled in a certain way did not get to see. That is wrong. And I think that this is different from all of the other issues that, you know, get conflated in this, which is the debate about the election integrity, the debate about Donald Trump. Put all that to one side. And I just want to remind everybody who was a liberal back in the early 2000s about how they felt about Guantanamo Bay and how there was so much sanctimony around. And you know what? I think these are rich debates even at the time for how even if you were guilty of back then what we would have viewed as the most heinous of crimes, helping plot a terrorist attack in the United States, there were committed liberals in this country who were still went to the mat on due process for terrorists who were held in Guantanamo Bay. Where are those people now? For I don't care if you agree with what somebody did on January 6th peacefully or not. You know, and that's a separate debate to have. But the most foundational one is that everyone in this country ought to be entitled to due process. That is a core constitutional concern. And I think our founding fathers are rolling over in their graves as they watch people who believe they were expressing their free speech rights. And we get to the facts of who did it peacefully and who didn't. Are you entitled to see exculpatory evidence before the government locks you up? Absolutely, because if not, what does it even mean to have due process in this country? That's really what sends chills down my spine, Jenna.
Yeah, absolutely. So well said. And, you know, to me, Vivek, I mean, this is, of course, not only a core constitutional concern, but also you mentioned the founders and how this is a fundamental part of what they were concerned about in our founding because they knew that the power of government to take away liberty could not happen without due process. And this is why of our Bill of Rights, our first 10 amendments, there are more protections included in the Bill of Rights in those first 10 amendments that deal with the context of a criminal prosecution than any other right, because they knew that was the liberty is the right that government most often infringes when it is politically driven. And that's why we have to make sure that there is due process. And when there isn't, as in this instance, it appears that there was exculpatory evidence that was not presented and not on behalf of any of the defense attorneys for their clients. And when due process doesn't happen, then that should undermine the prosecution's case. There should be sanctions. There should be penalties. There should be withdrawals of convictions. There should be overturning of convictions so that we make sure that we follow the process regardless of who the defendant is and whether or not politically we agree or disagree with their conduct. I mean, this, as you said, even for the most heinous offenses that you can possibly contemplate, those defendants in this country still get due process. So so is your position then here, I mean, would you agree with President Trump calling for the release of the detainees? Or what is your position as a presidential candidate?
So look, I think table stakes is anybody, and I don't care about whether the incident was January 6th or anything else, right? Because everybody else is looking through this through a politicized lens, especially from the left. I look at this through first principles of the Constitution, okay? And anybody who did not have access to to potentially exculpatory evidence, including video footage. I mean, I love the analogy that you've talked about, that you and I have talked about, you know, if you're a bank robber or an alleged bank robber and you're a defendant in a case, you don't just get access to the video footage with your own camera on the screen. You have to get access to the entire video footage if there's anything exculpatory as you look at full context. Nobody would dispute that in the case of a bank robbery. Why would they dispute it here when it comes to this video footage either? So my principles are constitutionally grounded. If there was any potentially exculpatory evidence that's now in the public domain that was denied to a defendant who had either pled or pressured to plead or actually did get convicted, I think that is grounds for vacating the conviction and retrying such a person under fair conditions when all evidence is made available. And I'll tell you this, Jen. I mean, this is just part of a pattern for me of look at the other presidential candidates in this race. I mean, from the explicit nature I've said of exactly how we're going to take on affirmative action to abandoning climate religion in this country to, you know, I've been quite vocal about which departments in the federal government I would shut down from the Department of Education to the FBI, which I've been crystal clear about, to, you know, even the use of the military south of the border to now, you know, yesterday I took a lot of time to process exactly what was released, wanted to get to the bottom of it. It's the constitutional principles that matter to me. I just want to see the other Republicans in this field be as explicit. I haven't seen, and, you know, I'm not knocking anybody else, but a lot of the other people either who are running or say they're going to be running appear to be hiding in the cave on this one, because their political consultants tell them the same thing my political consultants told me, that this is radioactive and you're not supposed to touch it, the same way they probably told them the same thing about race-based affirmative action. And I just think that we need Republican leadership. We need American leadership in this country who's not afraid to engage with the actual fraught issues of our day, because they're only fraught because we're not willing to talk about them based on first principles in the open. And you know what? I don't have those inhibitions. And I think it's important that we have somebody who understands deeply the complex challenges we face, but is also unafraid to take them on. And I don't mean to be boasting, Jenna. I'm more expressing a little bit of, you know, I would say somewhere between disappointment and wanting to encourage the other candidates to level up and let go of the culture of fear that has gripped the rest of our country. If that culture of fear even grips the Republican presidential field, where are we possibly going? That's what I say.
Yeah, so well said. And I think you're totally right that there has been this culture of fear. And that's what a lot of the Republican base has seen with a lot of the spineless, feckless Republicans who won't stand up for issues that maybe are a little bit controversial. But that's politics. Of course, things and positions, if you take a position, someone isn't going to like it. Someone who opposes it will say, I don't like that, and you'll get some pushback for it. But that's okay. And we need to, as a Republican Party and as conservatives, stand up boldly for the positions that we should be taking. And you have stood up firmly and have said very clearly on a number of issues, but especially and particularly this past week on the issue of shutting down the Department of Education, which now President Trump, after you have said that, he has now come out and said that he is also calling for shutting down the Department of Education, which and a lot of people didn't know that, you know, Jimmy Carter actually started and opened this agency. Reagan was the first one to suggest that we need to do away with this. I think it's a completely unconstitutional agency, and there are a wide variety of implications and problems to the states because of the Department of Education. But in his first term, you know, President Trump was talking about this with Secretary Betsy DeVos, but they ran into a lot of issues because of the swamp and the deep state. So what is your plan for actually accomplishing that and not just promising it on the campaign trail?
Great distinction. And I think that's one of the things that goes to the heart of why we need a president who actually understands the issue and has a bone-deep constitutional conviction himself, as opposed to doing what advisors said to do. Because here's what happens. Most presidents would think that you need to go to Congress for permission for this, because that's the standard perspective. I take a different view. Article 2 of the Constitution says that a lot of the civil service protections that, say, a president requires someone else's, you know, permission before firing someone who works for him, or these impoundment prevention provisions that say Congress, if they allocate money for a very specific purpose, the president has to spend it, those are unconstitutional, both on my reading of Article 2 as a constitutional one-time scholar, if I may say it so about myself, but also on grounds of just my chief executive experience And using that lens of reading the Constitution, which says that if somebody works for you and you can't fire them, that means they don't actually work for you. It means you work for them because, you know what, you're responsible for what they do without having any authority to actually determine it. That doesn't make sense. It's not what our framers had in mind when they said the president runs the executive branch of the government. Same thing with respect to money that you think shouldn't be spent on a particular purpose. If you're the chief executive of a company and you don't believe that that's the best use of capital, well, it's your decision of whether or not that capital should get spent on that project or a different one. Same analogy with respect to being the president of the United States. And so I think that's the combination of my understanding of the Constitution as a scholar, as a law, as a Yale law trained student and lawyer on one hand. On the other hand, converging with my experience actually running enterprises. And here's what I'll say about President Trump. I mean, I'm glad that he is now finally coming around to some of the views that I'm advancing. I think we're seeing a similar pattern from, look at what Governor DeSantis says on a given day, compare that to what I wrote in Woke Inc. a couple of years ago. I'm gratified. I'm really grateful. It's the best form of flattery to see your ideas espoused and even advanced by others. That's a good thing for the country. So I'm not going to be the kind of candidate who says, oh, they're stealing my ideas. No, far from it. We're in this for the country. The more of us that are talking about it, the better. My bet as a candidate is that the voters next year will reward the person who actually led the way. But my first principle isn't even who occupies the White House. I've said this countless times. We can decide the question of the who next year. This year has got to be about defining the what and the why. And now that I led the way, now that President Trump's gotten on board, I predict this will be part of the standard for what a Republican presidential candidate needs to pledge to do to shut down the Department of Education. And I'll just say a word about why that's important, Jenna, too. We skipped that part when I got into the constitutional argument. But you know, this is actually one of the quiet sources of wokeism in our schools. Not a lot of people know this. It's not just about school board members that have gone nuts. It's those school board members that are responding to economic incentives created by the federal government because they use their money as a sort of handcuff to say that as a condition for getting this money, you have to bend the knee to this particular agenda. See, that's a big part of the problem. And then you want to go further. You actually look at even the worker shortage we have in this country. Again, you get what you pay for. The Department of Education subsidizes four-year college education for gender studies majors in California, but does not subsidize in the same way two-year degrees for someone to become a welder or a carpenter or a builder. And I think that that imbalance gives us exactly some of the labor shortages we see in the country. So they're tilting the scales ideologically on the scale of wokeism, but even tilting the scales to expensive, debt-ridden, and often useless for many kids four-year college education. And so not only should it not exist as a constitutional matter, as a matter of first principles, where of course you and I agree on that, but it's having detrimental impact on the country itself. $80 billion spent through that agency that could instead be over $1.5 billion per state, even disproportionately allocated to students who might be able to actually better fund their school choice and allowing their parents to actually choose where they send their kids rather than have them be trapped in the poor public schools where they're trapped today. And so I think it's important, again, when I just think about this, just one example among many, Jenna, but you need somebody. We live in a complicated time. And I think we can't have somebody who's just executing on talking points that they read in a binder handed to them by someone or a book written by someone else, even if that someone else was me. I think that we need somebody who operates with a level of conviction that can cut through what the standard advisor or standard norm may be. And President Trump, I think, set the best example of that in 2015 and 2016. But you only get to be an outsider once. And as much as I respect the fact that he now wants to abolish the Department of Education, there was, between him and anyone else in this field, and myself included, there was one person who actually could have done it, and that was President Trump. And I think that he learned a lot, right? If I was in his position, one of my lessons learning from him is you can't reform agencies by just putting somebody good sitting on top. Betsy DeVos is great. She ran the Department of Education. But when these bureaucracies become so cancerous, there's exactly one answer. You shut them down. And if the Department of Education's case, I'd say you shut it down and leave it shut down. In the case 100%. Of the FBI, I've said we need to shut it down and replace it with something minimalist built from the ground up.
Well, 100%. And Vivek, this is why you are a leader on these issues and why I support 100% getting you to that debate stage. And everyone can go to Vivek2024.com, learn more about his platform, and we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
AFR programming is now available on Alexa.
You're joking, right?
Nope, not joking.
Seriously?
Yep, this is not a drill.
Wait a minute. No way.
There's a way. The Alexa way. So if you just happen to miss your favorite shows, no worries. You can now listen to each podcast with Alexa. It's simple and it's free. Just visit afr.net/apps and click Alexa. We're not joking. Washington Watch.
This is a crisis of our own making, and that hard-nosed determination to not admit it for political reasons is just really, truly disheartening.
Yeah, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but on this particular issue, the contrast between the policies of the two administrations could not be sharper. As I've mentioned here on the program many times, I was at the border a little over a year ago. It was like a ghost town.
Weekday afternoons at 4 Central and Saturday evenings at 6 Central on American Family Radio.
Now, these are the words of the letter which Jeremiah the prophet sent from Jerusalem to the rest of the elders of the exile, the priests, the prophets, and all the people whom Nebuchadnezzar had taken into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. Jeremiah 29:11 is one of the most quoted verses in Scripture, albeit usually out of context and misunderstood. Something that is often missed is that it is one sentence from an entire letter God sent to exiled Jews in Babylon. What should be noted here is that even in the midst of judgment, God still provided guidance and instruction to his people, anticipating their return to him.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner, or visit the podcast page at afr.net for more from Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Let's see, if something costs less, but people are happier with it, that sounds like something to look into, and that's MediShare. Maybe you've heard switching to MediShare to pay for healthcare can save the typical family $500 a month, and that's huge. But it's also true that people are way more satisfied after making the switch, too. The customer satisfaction rate for MediShare is double that of the typical health insurance plan. Double. MediShare works. It's been around for more than a quarter century, and members have shared more than $3 billion of each other's bills. People love having telehealth and a huge nationwide PPO network. So yeah, you can save a ton and like it better. Imagine being happy with how you're taking care of your health care. So if you're self-employed or part of the gig economy, or you just want a plan you're happy with, you can call right now and get a price within 2 minutes. A very, very smart use of 2 minutes. Here's the number you need. 833-44-BIBLE. That's 833-44-BIBLE. 833-44-BIBLE.
Speaking truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the morning.
And as some of you know, I was involved in what I believe is really the most historic lawsuit and fight of certainly my legal ministry, and I think in recent history, the historic stand that Pastor John MacArthur and the elders of Grace Community Church withstood and stood firm that church is essential and that church needed to be open in the midst of the COVID mandates and the unconstitutional actions of Gavin Newsom and the board of the city of Los Angeles. And we won a historic victory there. And for those of you who aren't aware of all of the particular details, what is so exciting is that Grace Community Church and GCC Productions is putting out a documentary that will be released in August that is telling the story of what actually happened and why John MacArthur and Grace Community Church decided to take this stand and what they went through and why this was such a historic victory for truth in God's providence. And so the trailer is going to be released on Friday. We're going to have the producer of the documentary on for the hour, so definitely tune in on Friday. But it is my pleasure right now to be joined by Pastor John MacArthur, who I just so respect and have come to dearly, dearly love even more than I did all growing up listening to his teaching ministry, reading his study Bible, and got to know personally him and so many of the elders at Grace Community Church through this battle. So Pastor John MacArthur, I love you and I respect you, and thank you so much for taking the time, and tell us why this particular documentary was so important to the church to tell the story of what happened.
Well, thank you, Jenna. We could never thank the Lord enough and thank you enough for popping up in our world and saying, I'm ready to help. That was a phenomenal work of the Lord, and you were an essential partner in the essential church. That's for sure. Well, the reason for doing the documentary is, you know, there were so many churches that folded up. There were so many churches that capitulated. So many pastors who, I think, overstressed. Submission to the government without balancing it off. The government has its domain, and it certainly doesn't reach into the church. There was just so much confusion, so much compromise, and I realized that if we could tell this story and tell it well, we might be able to prepare the church for the next one of these that's coming along. Because I don't think this totalitarian emphasis, this desire to control, is going to go away. As the culture continues to go down the black hole, and it seems blacker every year, you know, where are we now? We're at child mutilation being sponsored by the government. So what's going to happen in this whole thing is the church is going to be the last bastion of truth and conviction, not necessarily all churches, but the true church is going to take a stand. They're going to be the enemy. They're going to be the final enemy that has to fall. So I thought if we told this story and showed how God moved and blessed and honored our efforts, it might put some courage in the backs of church leaders down the road when the next issue faces the church.
I'm speaking with Pastor John MacArthur of Grace Community Church, and in telling this story, Pastor John, one of the things that was so remarkable to me that I really don't think others who are watching this from the outside or seeing this in hindsight really understood was how willing you were to actually go to jail for your faith and stand firm no matter the cost, because it's very easy to look back and say, well, of course we won, and this was a great stand because we won this almost $1 million verdict from, you know, settlement from the county, and all of these hurrahs, just like our founders at the very inception of this country, they ultimately won. And so we have the great blessings of liberty. But they were willing to go to their deaths to ensure the blessings of liberty. You were willing to stand up whatever the cost for the province and domain of the church, and that Jesus Christ is the head of the church. And so talk about that and how important of a perspective that was, because I think people really don't understand how your resolve never wavered.
Well, it starts obviously with the scripture. Christ is the head of the church, and I'm called to be faithful to the degree where the Apostle Paul was faithful, which meant that whatever town he went in to visit, he asked what the jail was like, not the hotel. He knew there was a price to pay, and eventually he paid the price of martyrdom. But the church was everything to him, and I think it has to be everything to us as well. We have to die on that hill. That's the hill we die on, is the integrity of the church and its autonomy from invasion by the kingdom of darkness. So that was an easy call, and it was also not only a biblical conviction of mine, but it was because of church history. The whole doctrine of Christ, the head of the church, basically sailed down to the present on a sea of blood. In the great battles of the Reformation, the great struggles of the Puritans, the great struggles of the Covenanters in Scotland, people gave their lives. There's a great story about Richard Cameron, who took a stand against the English monarchy encroaching on the church, and they killed his son, who was also a preacher, and they delivered his son's hands to him in a box at his house. And soon after that, if I remember right, they delivered his head. There were all kinds of martyrs. There are still places in Scotland where you can see where people gave their lives for the headship of Christ in the church. In those days, it was a combination of the Roman Catholic Church and the monarchy. But again, government has always been the primary persecutor of the church, because government is the only entity, really, that has legitimately the power of life and death. They're the only ones that have the authority to imprison. So ultimately, in every persecution, wherever it went throughout history, the government had to be complicit. If you're not part of the government, you don't have a jail. You don't own your own jail where you can, you know, hole up everybody who disagrees with you. So inevitably, government is the enemy when the conflict reaches its ultimate level. So understanding that historically, and how many, many Christians died, how many, for example, in the Great Ejection in the 1600s were thrown out of their pulpits, and many of them martyred for preaching Christ, the head of the church, not the King of England, not the Pope. So that is an embattled doctrine, and it was fought for with the shedding of a lot of blood. So when it came our turn to take a stand for the essential nature of the church, and particularly Christ as head of the church, that was just our turn, our time. The baton was handed to us, and I never wavered on that from the very beginning.
You didn't, and I saw that firsthand, and that gave me so much courage in my own faith and my own life as a Christian. And I think that also has inspired the next generation, when the baton will be passed to someone else next, and they will have to make that same determination. Will I stand for the truth, or will I acquiesce to an overbroad government that's trying to force me to comply with their edicts? And one of the things that we talked about very early on, Pastor John, was about how it was Gavin Newsom that was actually acting against the authority of the government. Because here in America, we have such a great blessing of the protections of our supreme law of the land that have a separation of authority between church and state, not how the leftists manipulate that whole narrative, but the jurisdiction of the state versus the church versus the family. Of course, people like Gavin Newsom and those that are disposed to usurp the province of the church want to intentionally try to make Christians acquiesce under this banner of, well, we're loving our neighbor and we have to yield to those authorities. And so for the pastors of churches now that, and I know you're having Shepherd's Conference coming up this week, for the pastors who look at this stand and say, well, we have to acquiesce to the government when it's okay and when it's really not giving up much. I mean, why can't we close our doors just for a few months? Why can't we acquiesce to this in a spirit of loving our neighbor and a lot of those different excuses that I think they'll use the next time around? What is your message coming out of this experience to the pastors to stand firm on biblical truth that never does waver?
Well, I don't think there's any scenario in which the government can shut the church down other than by sheer military force. I mean, the only time the church should be shut down is when they come after all of us and throw us in jail. Short of that, no matter what exigencies are going on in the society or culture, in fact, the worse it is, the more the church is desperately needed. But this is very obvious when you think about the fact that we have reached a point of morality, or the lack of morality, that is insanity in the transgender world and in the homosexual world. That they basically are the new power in our country. They wield the power. They even wield the power behind the government. It's bizarre to think that a deviant sin would be the thing that the government is most concerned to defend, except for the fact that you understand the whole world lies in the lap of the evil one. So you have to understand that whatever the pretense, pandemic, whatever that might be, vaccination mandate, climate change, whatever the next issue is, there is no edict from the government or any government to close the church. That's for God to decide, and he demands that we be open and preach the gospel to every creature and be faithful proclaiming the word of God. Could it be dangerous? Sure. We could lose our lives, not by a virus, but, you know, like those in history lost their lives by imprisonment or martyrdom or whatever. But the worse the times are, and I can't fathom that they've ever been as bad as they are in our culture, this is where the church is even more needed. Of course, we've seen that at Grace Church. The place is exploding with people. We've taken in, I think, almost 2,000 new members in the last 2 years.
Wow.
From people who just came to church because there wasn't another church to go to. They were confused, and they found a home at Grace, and they found strength. And as the whole thing began to be understood realistically, we find out that the virus wasn't that deadly, that the vaccine may be more deadly than the virus. And so we know we were lied to, and that's an important piece of this, because we now know that the government will lie to achieve its own ends.
Really well said, and I think your admonition, Pastor John, to the next generation of leaders, and whether it's literally tomorrow or it's however many years in the future, if we have that long and the Lord tarries that long, we have to set our view of Scripture on truth, and we have to be confident in our convictions and what the Bible teaches about the essential church before we ever get the baton passed to us. And if you didn't have that resolve, it might have been very easy to have all kinds of excuses, like many other churches did, for closing or for conceding to government. But we need to be very vigilant. And you know, you mentioned the transgender movement. It is not a surprise or a mistake, I don't think, that we're seeing the pervasiveness of the transgender movement infiltrating these other so-called churches, and I don't think they are really churches, by having the new priests of that religion. And in just the last 20 seconds that I have with you, thank you so much, Pastor John, and I would really encourage people to go and watch this trailer, watch The Essential Church, and go to theessentialchurch.com and make sure that you are supporting this project if you can. It's going to come out in August. Listen to us on Friday, when we'll have the producer on. And Pastor John, thank you so much for always standing firm that the church is essential.
Yeah, thank you for being such a champion on our behalf. We're deeply grateful. God bless you.
God bless you too. All right, we will be back tomorrow with more of Jenna Ellis in the Morning right here on American Family Radio Network.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.